One of my favorite works of poetry is a ballad by G.K. Chesterton called The Ballad of the White Horse. It's the story of Alfred, who some 11 centuries ago was an English king, who reigned over his little kingdom and fought to save it at a time when all the world seemed to be going dark. That little kingdom on the edges of Christian civilization was heir to many great things from the ancient world. It was heir to the Roman quest for order and for justice, to the Greek quest for beauty and for wisdom, most of all, to the Christian quest to look upon the very face of God. And suddenly, and without warning, it was confronted by invaders who came in long ships over the sea out of the north, the Vikings, the Danes, who destroyed everything they touched, who with heavy hands tore down the monasteries and upset the farm and the family, who burned the books of ancient wisdom and left in their path a trail of fire and fury all around the perimeter of the Christian world, from England to France to Spain to Italy. It was a time when the world seemed to be falling apart, when all the lights seemed to be going out. As Chesterton retells the story, the moving story of King Alfred, he retells a legend about that king. The legend is that one day Alfred went wandering from his camp and his army, taking no weapons with him but only his harp. He wandered unknown into the camp of the Danes, who didn't recognize him, didn't know that he was the English king, but they saw his harp and challenged him to a sort of musical contest. As Chesterton tells the legend, and the contest begins between the Viking lords and the English king, they begin to sing, and their song begins to explain the world that they believe in and for which they are fighting. As the Viking chieftains sing, they sing of how they take whatever they want, how they grab whatever they can get, how they enjoy the whole world. And yet, paradoxically, their song is touched by a deep sorrow. Although superficially, they have every cause for joy. After all, they're winning the battle, and the world seems to be their plaything. In their hearts, there lives a deep despair. For despite the fact that the whole world is at their fingertips, they can seem to think of nothing worthwhile to do with it. And in their hearts, they feel the sorrow that comes from a life without meaning. Paradoxically, in Alfred's song, there is a defiant and indomitable joy. Despite the fact that his people are fighting for their survival, despite the fact that it seems that they may lose, despite the fact that their whole world seems to be falling apart, Alfred has a song to sing. He has some joy in his heart. For as a Christian, he worships a God who came down into the heart of human suffering and transformed its meaning forever. He worships a God who knows how to bring resurrection after death, who knows how to bring victory after defeat. And because he had a hope that is founded in heaven, it could not be beat down by all the sorrows of this world. In one haunting line, Chesterton has Alfred taunt the Viking chiefs, who seem to be merry, but in fact are sad. And Alfred speaks to them of men wandering ceaselessly, if it be not better to fast for joy than to feast for misery. He asks the Vikings, in other words, whether the Christian who denies himself, who fasts, who suffers, who sacrifices, because his heart is filled with a joy and a hope that cannot be contained by this world, is not happier than the pagan, crushed by despair, who tries to distract himself for a moment with worldly pleasures in a futile attempt to hide his tears. What was the source of King Alfred's joy? Long before the Vikings came to England, and long after, pagans, both ancient and modern, have accused Christianity of being a sad religion. After all, Christian morality requires a fair amount of self-denial. It requires saying no to sinful pleasures. After all, the very symbol of Christianity is the cross, a sign of suffering and shame. And Jesus Christ himself said, "If you would be my disciple, you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me." For all its history, Christianity has been accused by its critics for this reason of being sad. And so it might surprise such a critic, ancient or modern, to read the story that we have in the gospel today. It's the story of Jesus' first miracle, or as St. John describes it, the beginning of his signs, the beginning of the wonders by which he would manifest to the world who he is and what he came to do. The miracle is a transformation of water into wine, the transformation of what is merely sufficient to sustain life into something which is a sign of abundant and overflowing joy. Jesus comes to a wedding, to a celebration of life and of love, but the wine is running out. The wedding might have ended in embarrassment for the host. It might have ended in a party that was devoid of good cheer, but Christ renews their wine. He pours abundance into their lives. He gives joy to their hearts. And when he did so, he not only manifested his divine power over nature, but he taught us that it is his grace that gives joy to the heart, that he has the power to give a joy which is stronger than every sorrow. This morning, as we meditate on Christ's first miracle, I'd like to consider for a moment just how it is that he places the wine of his grace in our heart to give us a joy that is stronger than all the sorrows of this world. Psychologically speaking, joy comes about whenever some good thing that we love is present to us. That's why we rejoice in a beautiful sunrise, not so much when we hear it described to us as when we see it. That's why we smile when we come upon an old friend unexpectedly. When some good thing draws near, the result in our soul is joy. And for this reason, the joys of this world are characteristically short-lived and fleeting. Fame, power, riches, all these things are uncertain. All these things are easily lost. The man who sets his heart above all things on money can never be quite free of the anxiety of what will happen to its wealth. And the pleasures of this world quickly flee away. For this reason, earthly joy has a transitory character. Everyone knows it doesn't last. And even in the midst of earthly rejoicing, we can't escape the sadness of knowing that it will come to an end. But Christian joy is altogether different. Christian joy is founded on the drawing near of a good thing far better than all the good things of this world. Christian joy is founded on the drawing near of God who is infinitely good, infinitely happy, of God who wants to share his life with us. And my brothers and sisters, he is sweeter than honey and more precious than gold, and he has drawn intimately close to us. This is one of the great messages of the Christmas season, which we have just celebrated. One of the names that the angel gives to Jesus is Emmanuel, literally God with us. The God who dwells in heaven, who made us and who loves us, has drawn close to us. He shares our human nature. He became a little baby like we were once. He lived in a family as a little child like we do. He has drawn very, very close. And not only in our joys, but in our sorrows too. He knew what it was to wander without a place to lay his head. He knew what it was to hunger and to thirst. Knew what it was to be misunderstood, to be falsely accused, to be betrayed by a friend. Knew what it was on the cross to suffer indescribable physical pain. Knew what it was at last even to die. And for 3 days, his body lay in the cold stone of a tomb outside Jerusalem. And this is the point. The incarnation has written over all the long history of human sorrow and human tears this great truth: you are not alone. You are not alone. No matter what you may have to suffer, no matter how dark the sky may be, you are not alone. He came. He came right down into the maelstrom of human suffering. He is close to us. He has suffered with us and for us, and he has changed the meaning of our suffering forever. For he showed us, by his example, how to suffer with courage and with love. And his grace is at work in our hearts to strengthen us to the task, to strengthen our knees, to strengthen our arms, to help us to face the danger, to sacrifice and to suffer if need be, and to give value to everything that happens that is undergone with love. And just as his sufferings have meant salvation for the whole world, just as he has taken his own passion from a certain point of view, the worst thing that ever happened, and turned it on his head and made it the cause of our joy, and transformed the cross from a sign of suffering and humiliation into a sign of victory and blessing. So his grace holds out the possibility that even in the depths of our suffering, the meaning of what we have to undergo might also be transformed. That in the midst of sorrow that weighs upon our heart, we might find a deep, an abiding, a defiant, an indomitable joy, which is founded on a hope beyond this world, and therefore cannot be beat down by earthly sorrow. This joy that he came to pour into the world is symbolized by the wine that he poured into the world as he worked his first miracle. His grace, my brothers and sisters, rejoices the heart, even in the midst of tears. And that joy, that Christian joy, which found its way in dark times into the heart of King Alfred, who still had some song to sing, has not, in the history of the church, been an uncommon phenomenon. There was a reason that St. Anthony of the Desert could sell all he had and give it to the poor and smile at the exchange. There was something in the heart of St. Maximilian who, even though locked in a hole in the center of the death camp at Auschwitz and left to starve, could go on singing in the darkness until his last breath. There was a reason why the apostles in the book of Acts could go away from being beaten and persecuted, rejoicing that they had been counted worthy to suffer for the sake of the name. There is a reason why the man in the parable who finds a treasure in the field goes and in his joy sells all he has to find it. There was a reason why on the night before he died, the night in which he spoke so much of suffering and of laying down one's life, Jesus could say to his disciples, "I have told you these things that my joy might be in you, and that your joy might be full." My joy, my joy might be in you. My brothers and sisters, he is talking about the divine joy, about the joy of God, in which he wants to make us share. For God is infinitely good, infinitely happy. He made the whole world to manifest his glory. He made you and me to share in his happiness, and even now, his laughter, his mirth is shaking the heavens. I have come that my joy might be in you, and that your joy might be full. For this reason, he came to our world. For this reason, he suffered on the cross. For this reason, he worked his first miracle at a wedding at Cana in Galilee, that you and I might see and understand, that you and I might taste the wine.